Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First in the list is Netpipes. This is a package name, Netpipes. That's not the command you'll be using. But Netpipes contains two commands, well, probably more, I don't know. Notable commands called faucet and hose. Yeah, there's encapsulate, there's get peer name, there's sock down and time limit as well. But the classic example of a net pipe is an interaction that you make with faucet and hose. This is sort of an alternative, a quick and easy alternative to an SCP. Well, I shouldn't say SCP, more like an RCP. It's a connection that you can make between two hosts on your network based on, I guess I'm going to call it implicit permissions. That's not an official term. That's just kind of how I think of it. And I say it that way because for this process to work, one of the computers on your network must be running a command that listens for incoming connections. And if it is not, then any call to that computer obviously is going to not work. It won't connect. So there's no password, there's no username, account, login. This is simply as long as the destination computer is running the command to listen to an incoming connection, a known incoming connection, then you've got a connection. So it's what I'm calling an implicit permission. It's like, yeah, I give you permission to connect because if I didn't, I wouldn't have run this command. That's one way to think of it. I guess you can also think of it as push and pull. You can be pushing from one computer, but if you don't ever pull from another, then you don't get the data. However you want to think about it, that's the setup. And the two components involved are faucet and hose. Now the faucet, that in at least American English, the faucet is the tap. It is the component of like a sink, or it's a connection on the outside of your house, maybe in the back garden, where you hook up a hose so that you can, and you turn on the tap so you can get water to, I don't know, water your veggie garden or wash your hands or wash your dishes or whatever. So that's the faucet. So the faucet is going to be the source of data. And in order for the faucet to exist, you need to be running it on a computer. And this is considered the server. Now, of course, we know, you and I, dear listener, we know that a server doesn't mean it's some big, you know, metal box in a big rack of other metal boxes off in a data farm somewhere. A server can be any computer that happens to be running faucet on your network. So on Alice's computer, we'll run Alice being a fictional character in this network. On Alice's computer, we're going to run faucet 1234. That's the port. We're creating a port that is prepared to provide data from Alice's computer. So faucet. Actually, before we do any of this, I'm going to echo hello world and redirect that into a file called helloworld.txt. All right, that exists. And that's the only thing that exists in my current directory. Alice doesn't have much on her computer. She's just got one text file that says helloworld.txt. I'm in a subdirectory of her home directory, so there's nothing else but helloworld.txt. That is important. Okay, so now I'm going to type in faucet, F-A-U-C-E-T, space, 1234. That's the port I'm going to use. And then I'm going to do --out. So this is telling faucet what to do with standard out. It's defining standard out. So I'm saying --out is tar cf create file, tar cf space --, so everything that's in standard input, and then dot. What that means is I want tar, when it receives a request from the outside at port 1234, I want it to tar up everything here, dot, in this current directory. I want it to tar it up and provide it over this whatever data connection. So that's faucet1234--out --tar-cf-dot. Not a beautiful command, but that's what it is. So now on some other computer, Bob's computer, well, Bob wants the data that Alice is offering. So he is going to connect a hose, H-O-S-E, to the faucet. That's what this command is going to do. So again, in the real world analogy, this is you going to the faucet in the back of your house, at the back of your garden, whatever, and you're connecting a garden hose to it so that the water coming out of the faucet travels down the hose, and now you have water wherever you want it. That's what the hose is here for. So we've got the hose command. There's a faucet offering data. Let's connect a hose to it and get it onto our computer. Makes sense. Hose, space, in this case, I'm going to do 192.168.122.82 because that's my little virtual machine that is running faucet. So that's Alice's IP address. If we were using host names and fancy things like that, then we would just type in, you know, Alice or Alice's computer or whatever. What's the port? It's 1234. So space, 1234, and that's just because, again, the faucet command used 1234 as its port, so that's where we're going for this data flow. --in, standard input now, is what we're defining. We're saying whatever hose is getting in to its standard input, here's what I want you to do. I want you to do a tar XVF, so that's extract verbosely the file, space dash, which is standard input. And now I'm going to hit return on that. And I get, because I said verbose output, I get a good amount of output here. And the most notable is .slash and .slash helloworld.txt. That's what was in the tar archive. We know this. We sent it with the over a faucet. So, and indeed, if I do an ls on my current directory, there's helloworld.txt. And if I cat helloworld.txt, I get the message hello world, which is what I had typed in. If I go back over to Alice's computer, the faucet is still running. It's received the request and it has satisfied the request, but that doesn't mean that it stops. It's still running unless I pass the flag dash dash once, I think. Then it just serves it once and then quits the command. You can even run this in daemon mode. I don't know if I would, but you could. Dash dash daemon puts faucet, you know, starts faucet and then sends it to the background. So you get your terminal prompt back and your computer is just serving up a file or a whole directory of files or whatever you want to serve to anyone who approaches it with the hose command at your IP address at the correct port. They'll receive that data. It's pretty cool. I mean, it's a great alternative or a possible alternative, I think, to that, you know, that ubiquitous Python command that you see online all over the place where they're like, oh, start a minimal web server with one single Python command, which is useful. And it's great for people whose computer ability barely gets them to a web browser, to a host name or IP address so that they can see the contents of your directory and then click on something to download it. I mean, if that's where someone is, then I probably wouldn't introduce them to the magic of faucet and hose. But if it's people who are in a terminal anyway, this is a really easy way to just, you know, broadcast to your local network, hey, I've got this important work file or this 3D model file or this graphic that everyone needs to refer to, whatever. Just hose my IP address, this port, tar XVF dash, and you'll get it into your current directory just like that. So it's a pretty neat little command, I think. You know, I think its usage is, there's probably parameters around how useful it is in the real world and whether you would want to be just kind of running it all the time and kind of the fact that it doesn't encrypt anything between the two hosts and that there's really no authentication process other than, oh, you know my IP and the port I was serving that file at. But I think we can all imagine a scenario where that would be a pretty useful little shortcut. So keep it in mind, keep in mind that it exists, and who knows, maybe you'll get some use out of it. Okay, the other commands in the package I don't feel are as realistically useful. I mean, get peer name is good. That gets information about you know, the connection that you're that you've, you know, the faucet that you're connecting to. Essentially, you'll get some information about that, and really the way that you do that is you open the you connect a hose to that location, and you do the --in as get peer name, and then you get some information back. So yeah, that is cool. That's really useful. It's a little bit almost of a, you know, you could probably argue that it's maybe a little bit like a Telnet replacement in a way. But yeah, it's, I don't know. There's other ways to get a lot of information from stuff, as we've seen, SNMP and stuff like that. And then there's SOC down and time limit and encapsulate. Encapsulate's really interesting. Read the man page. I just don't see how it's, I don't believe it's that broadly useful, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. And in fact, I'm not going to spend any time on it. That's kind of all about netpipes that I found really, really interesting. So let's move on to Nettle. Nettle is a library for cryptography. So it gives you in your C code? Yeah, or C++ code. The ability to do common and Python, actually. C++, Python. And I think there are bindings for a couple of other, like TCL and Haskell and a couple of other, languages. So it gives you the ability to do common sort of cryptography functions. Just really, I mean, literally by calling a Nettle function. So you could do a Nettle slash SHA-1.h in your includes, and then you suddenly have the ability to do a SHA-1 init and pipe some information into it and let it process all that and calculate the SHA-1. Bang, you've got a SHA-1, and so on. Obviously, there's more than just SHA-1, but that's the example that it gives on the website. The website is lisator.liu.se. It's pretty simple. There's a manual there. So if you want to use this library, there's good documentation on how to. Oh, Perl as well. Haskell, Perl, Pyke. I don't know what that is. Pyke. Rust, Python, TCL, and then, yeah, C++, and so on. So yeah, that's Nettle. Not much to say about it. It just kind of does what it is designed to do, I guess. I mean, I've not used it. NetWatch is up next, and this is a network monitoring tool. It's really kind of cool. So you do need sudo permissions for this, probably, because it wants to, you know, like, listen in on your network connection. But sudo netwatch return takes over your password, takes over your terminal, and on the left side of the screen is your local host, and on the right side of the screen are the remote hosts. You can use the right and left arrows to scroll through different pieces of information that you might want to see about these connections. So for instance, as I scroll through, I see things like local packets, the IP, the kind of service, the... just crashed. That's interesting. Let's see what else. Somewhere in here I had, the protocol, like UDP or TCP, and it crashed again. Interesting. NetWatch is not performing well right now, and that, it did crash once when I was first trying it, but not like that. So, you could see also, like, different kinds of servers or, you know, connections like HTTP server, FTP server. You can see, guest MAC addresses. Sometimes they're not, you know, they don't know because you don't necessarily get that information on all connections, but the when it has that information, it shows that information, how many bytes we're talking about, what host you're talking to through a specific local connection, and so on. There's a good help screen if you hit H. I don't know how to get out of that, unfortunately. How do I get out of this? I forget. Escape? It says escape, but it doesn't... Oh, there it goes. Okay, so escape a couple of times gets rid of the help message. N on your keyboard clears your screen, so if you've just gotten to the point where you feel like you've got too much information and you just kind of want to see, you know, you want to see an update, I guess. I mean, it updates as you go, so I don't exactly know what that's for, but suppose you you just want to see what happens if you clear everything out and, you know, kind of rebuild the list of connections. You can hit N for November and or network, and it'll start that over. So yeah, it's an interesting little application. I have it in mind that it would probably be something that I would look to when I suspected or when I knew what to expect, and I would look at it for confirmation or for maybe a little bit more information about something. I can imagine using it then. I don't think I would probably realistically just kind of have it open, and I wouldn't, I don't think I'd just be monitoring it on its own. Just because, I mean, that's a lot of IP addresses to stare at, and if that doesn't mean a whole lot to you in the moment, then it might not be that informative to you. I mean, it might. It depends on what you're looking at. And certainly if you're testing, say, a new NF table, NF table or IP table, whatever, then maybe that would be really useful to know. Like, am I getting out of my own network here? NetWatch could help you determine that. So not a bad little application to know about, I think. And feel free to try it out, I guess. Next up is network scripts. These are the basic scripts and files used to define the network that you are using on Slackware. Like, these are the rc.inet1 and rc.inet2 scripts that you launch, you know, that get launched out of the /etc/rc.d file folder, and several of them are borrowed from BSD or written by Fred N. Van Kampen and or Patrick Volkerding himself, with an allowance for all the kind of the sort of, I don't know, casual collaboration that happens within the Slackware development cycle. And if you don't know, like, if you go to linuxquestions.org, Patrick Volkerding is pretty active there. I mean, when I say active, I'm not saying he hangs out and posts about what he had for breakfast, but I mean, he does clearly read linuxquestions.org, the Slackware division, the Slackware sort of channel or whatever, the category, and a lot of collaboration does actually happen there. You might not know it if you don't know it, but yeah, that's where people kind of like report bugs and ask questions. And if something's surprising or, you know, not what someone expected, then very frequently, like, you can find out more about either the solution or the expectation or how to, you know, like, or you can get Patrick to fix something in the event that it's actually broken. I don't think I've ever posted there and called Patrick out by name. You know, it's not a chat forum. But if you post about it, then the community can chip in, and then eventually, if it is beyond the community or if it really is a problem, you know, that can't be fixed, then oftentimes Patrick Volkerding takes note of that and then fixes it. So it's like I said, casual collaboration. It's kind of like, this is how Slackware gets really iterated upon, which is by community involvement. linuxquestions.org. You can see these scripts for yourself. I mean, like I say, it's rc.inet1 and rc.inet2, and then things like hosts.conf and hosts.allow and hosts.deny, and even like a setup script, like the network setup script. So if you want to see how this stuff kind of like gets started and gets instantiated, like, these are the scripts to look at. It's pretty interesting, and I think, you know, kind of a testament in a way of just kind of that traditional Unix-like process of, here's some scripts, we're going to launch them at a specific time, they're going to execute some specific actions, and then we're done. Everything's set repeatably. It's automation at work. Definitely something to look at and something to keep in mind, I think, as you build systems for yourself. What kind of allowance for, you know, catching errors, or for catching errors before they happen, or for, you know, yeah, for like bailing out, like, oh, this, an error has happened, I will not continue. Then how do you alert that failed? Where do you put that information? All that kind of stuff. Honestly, most of what I've learned about shell scripting and sort of automation and just kind of repeatability, most of that I've learned from, or I should say the foundational aspects of that. And for a very long time, most of what I have learned from just reading the components of Slackware. It is just endlessly educational. And if it's over your head today, come back to it in a year. It'll be like you're reading a completely new thing. You have more context, you'll have more understanding, greater understanding, and you might learn something new. Well worth it. I think it's probably time for coffee is what I'm thinking. But let's really quick just knock NetWrite out of the way. It's a really simple one. This is the daemon, the write d daemon essentially, that gets run out of, I think The description says rc.inet. No, I guess it's just from inetd. Okay, so from the inet daemon, writed can be run. It is the daemon that listens on port 811 for the write command. So it's a really, really simple, not secured by any kind of encryption or authentication protocol that allows someone on your network to run the write program, WRITE, and you do that with just, you know, you write to a user, maybe on a specific TTY, a message, and then you're chatting with a person, and in their terminal they see a message that says message from, you know, your username Klaatu at example host on this TTY at this time, and then it broadcasts the message. As I've said before, I've actually worked on a network that had this kind of thing enabled. It was actually useful. I didn't use it often, but people did use it, and it was pretty handy, because it's just kind of like, why bother running an entire chat server? Yes, certainly going out onto the network on the World Wide Web, which wasn't even allowed, because, I mean, you could go out to the World Wide Web, but you weren't allowed to, like, have chat stuff open, because we were working on movies that were highly, highly under, you know, non-disclosure agreements that would have huge legal ramifications if there were story leaks or screenshots. So that was not allowed. And instead, we just, when we needed to get one another messages, we used Write. And it was that easy. It was really, really simple. And it was just there in your terminal. So you could just select, you know, the command that the person was describing to you, or the URL, you know, whatever, the file location, and just paste it right back into your terminal and use it. It was super, super simple and quite convenient. Again, not something that we actually used all that often, because there were other channels of communication, but it was one of those things that you had in your back pocket. You could use it when you needed it, and it was kind of easy and convenient. So that's NetWrite. That is really the in.writed daemon. It just runs and listens for the write command, and then lets that message get posted into your terminal. Okay, let's go get a cup of coffee, and we'll come back. We'll finish up the show. And I'm back. I've got coffee. You've got coffee. Next one's a real simple one because I can't really do anything with it. It's called NewsPost. It is an autoposter to Usenet. Usenet, of course, I mean, I think I must have talked about it when we were talking about PAN, which I probably basically skipped over at the time because I've never really interfaced with news groups, or at least I hadn't. I've recently started to kind of look into it just out of sheer curiosity for alternative protocols, and Usenet uses, I guess, NNTP or UUCP. It kind of depends on what part of the process you're talking about, from what I understand. This does that. This will interface with like an NNTP server, copy a file up to it, assuming you have an account and a login and the address of a Usenet server and so on. Now, these days, Usenet servers are typically something that you pay for. They're not just out there like I guess they used to be. But there are those that exist. I mean, there's some that have existed since the 90s. There's one that exists since the 90s. I don't know the lineage of all of them, and I don't really know for sure that one is the same, you know, group of owners, but whatever. It's the same name. They claim to have existed since the 90s. So yeah, there are Usenet servers out there that you can sign up for. You pay a monthly subscription fee or access fee, whatever, and then you have, whatever Usenet is, which, to look at it, it's a little bit, it's kind of, I guess, like an unholy mix of the World Wide Web, email, and RSS. That's kind of how it feels to use Usenet, to me at least, having no real history with Usenets to speak of. That's kind of how it strikes me, especially if you're using a Usenet reader or a news reader like PAN, for instance, on Slackware, P-A-N. You connect to a server, and then you've essentially got an inbox, or you've got lots of inboxes, let's call them. They're not really inboxes, but again, kind of framing it in concepts that you and I, as modern computerists, understand them. It's sort of like you've got just a whole bunch of inboxes that you didn't make. They're just there, and you can click on them and download the headers, and then read messages with titles that interest you. And it is just that. It's just a bunch of messages from people. So it's a little bit like an RSS feed. In fact, it's even everything that you see you could download as an NZB file, which is an XML file. So it really kind of is like RSS in that sense. But I mean, it's got the feel of like, you know, like an online forum or even a social network. And it is all online, but it's not what, you know, it's not HTTP. It's not that protocol. It is, I mean, and it gets confusing because the protocols are, you know, the news groups have been mirrored on www, the World Wide Web, the internet, the HTTP protocol. So you might see reflections of it there, but natively, it is a decentralized network speaking between NNTP services and copying files, putting files on other people's servers, and then downloading them potentially from those servers. And that's what a Usenet, or that's what the Usenet is. That's what the user network is. So it's actually kind of cool, but yeah, it does require a little bit of an investment if you want to go to the places where, you know, you'll actually see activity. There is a free one called eternal-september.org. You'll be hard-pressed to find a whole lot of activity, although some group within Debian actually does post to it pretty frequently as they debug this or that. The herd kernel on Debian is pretty active on eternal-september.org. So if you want to keep up with the testing of the GNU herd kernel running underneath Debian, then that's one place you could do that. You can follow along. It's kind of fascinating, actually. So were you to do that, and you decided that you wanted to post something to that news group, then you could use, in theory, NewsPost. Now, NewsPost has a bunch of options that I don't even understand all of them. There's .par files, which I think are like part files for things that you have to split up into several parts. But the basic command is what I've gotten to work, and that's newspost-i for, I don't know, IP, something. None of these options make any sense to me. -i, news dot, let's say you're using, I guess example.com. So news.example.com, -u, clatu, -p, okay, that one actually made sense, -u, username, clatu. So again, I would have had to have registered for this theoretical news server on example.com, and I would have registered with clatu as my username. So -u, clatu, -p, password 123, -F, this is your display name. Again, makes no sense. I don't know what -F stands for, but let's say that's what it is. So I'd put clatu maybe, and then -f, again, don't know what that means, but it is your email address that you want to show, you know, where this post came from. I don't know if this is like an artifact of old Usenet or what, but I mean, you have an account here. So what's the point of posting a display name and an email? Not really sure. It doesn't make any sense to me, but you could put an email address in there. It doesn't have to be, as far as I understand, doesn't have to be anything real, because this isn't the authentication. This is just for your header, basically. This is just the header of like name, email, and subject line. So I'll just put clatu at nospam GNU World Order.info. And then dash S as in subject, and that would be the subject line. So maybe I would do like, quote, testing the news post command, close quote. And then dash N is the news group that you want to post to within the NNTP server, the Usenet server that you are posting to. And for that, you'd have to know what news groups exist, or you'd have to have permission, I guess, to create your own. But I mean, in theory, you'd have a list, maybe, you know, because you've registered and maybe you've logged on to the server and you've looked at what news groups are available. So maybe you're doing a alt.test.group news group. Then you would alt.test.group would be the news group, and then dash Z for the port number that you want to go to with this when you're sending the information. And again, that would have been given to you during registration, probably. They would have told you, here's what ports we run on. It could be, there are likely different ports for different, you know, whether you're using SSL or whether you're just posting in the clear. So let's just call it 443 or something. And then dash Y is to use Yen code instead of UUIN code. Yen code supposedly is kind of smaller and quicker and so on. So maybe you would want to use that. So dash Y, there's no option, there's no argument to that. It's just dash Y to use Yen code. Otherwise, it'll default to UUIN code. And then finally, the file that you want to post. Now, NewsPost specifically says it's meant to post binary files. So you might want to post a binary file, not like a text message. Basically, it would have to be, you'd want to just do the binary portion. So it could be like I just have like a pixel, literally a single pixel saved as a WebP file, because that's a great little test file to do things with. So I just do pixel.webp and then hit return. It figures out what it needs to do to this binary file. It tells you a little bit about what you're posting. One file, 15 bytes, yen coding, 15 bytes total, and posting to news.example.com. 15 bytes, one part, 91 bytes encoded, posting part one of one, 99% done, and so on. It steps you through the sort of reports on the process, and then it posts your file to your news group. Now you've posted a binary file to a news group. And if you go to your news reader, like PAN or whatever, and you fetch the latest headers for that news group, specifically alt.test.group in this example, in this theoretical example, then ideally you'll see your post pop up there in your news reader. And so will everyone else. That's the idea of one of these news groups. That's NewsPost. That's how that works. The next one is NF account or NFACT. I don't want to get into that yet because we're going to talk about NF tables in a moment. So let's skip that for a moment and just talk about the next one, which is NFS utils. NFS utils contains daemons to run. I just clicked on the ASC file, the signature file. The NFS utilities package contains necessary daemons and utilities to run an NFS server on Linux. This has the NFS stuff. You also do need the RPC bind package, which I think we talked about at some other point. I kind of vaguely remember that. So anyway, NFS utils is kind of the you know, when you say you're going to run an NFS server, this is the thing that's doing the heavy lifting for you. And speaking of heavy lifting, Slackware does so much heavy lifting for you. This is the kind of thing that just really kind of gets overlooked in Slackware sometimes, I think. Just the fact that on Slackware, there are so many things on Slackware that you just already have either 100% or like 95% configured. Like, it's just already there. It's so nice. It is just so nice. So, NFS, and you know, other Linux distributions provide the same service. I'm not saying Slackware is the only one. I'm just saying it is really nice on Slackware how these things are packaged up and practically ready for you to go. And I mean, frankly, NFS would be ready for you out of the box on Slackware, but for the fact that you have to tell it what, you know, by nature of the configuration file of NFS, you have some decisions to make, and Slackware is not going to make those decisions for you because they're potentially pretty major. So, there's a lot of different options. I'm just going to kind of do a proof of concept here. And I've run several NFS servers before. I say several. I've run a few. And I know, I think during the RPC bind, I said, you know, does anyone really ever use NFS anymore? And I don't know that they do. But it's not a bad system to know about for your local network at the very least, because it is kind of a quick and easy way to share files across a lot of different operating systems, or at least two of them. Linux and Mac both do NFS pretty smoothly. I should say, 10 years ago, when I knew what Mac OS was up to, vaguely, I believe, if I recall correctly, it was really pretty natively built in. Certainly in Cupertino for a while, there was a running joke that Sun Microsystems was the server division of Apple. I mean, that wasn't true. Apple had their own server division, although it was constantly under threat of being canceled. But that was the running joke. So Apple tended to play pretty nicely with Sun Microsystems. I mean, certainly they were both, you know, California-based computer vendors who were running Unix. So I just feel like there was some crossover there. So NFS, it's a way to essentially export a file system, meaning you're granting your computer, which we'll call a server for now, but again, it doesn't have to be a server on a rack. It could just be a computer in your closet or your computer on your desk, and you want to share files from that with your partner who's over in the other room and has a Linux box, or I guess a Mac OS box as well, maybe Windows. I don't know. I don't know the compatibility these days for NFS. It used to be pretty darn strong, and you can just share that folder. So you're essentially, quote unquote, exporting that folder to some other host. You can also just export it to all hosts, but I think the theory is that you would know the hosts to which you are exporting this directory and what kind of permissions they have to rummage around in your file system. So to start NFS, and we'll restart it later, but to start it just to kind of get it up and running, it's sudo space sh or bash or whatever you want to do, some shell, space slash etc slash rc.d slash rc.nfsd, as in demon, space start. So this is a built-in little startup script that Patrick Volkerding provides on Slackware, and that's how you start a service on Slackware. It's pretty much the same as any other service like the Apache HTTPD or, you know, any other thing that we've launched out of etc/rc.d over the course of this series. And what we've just done is we've started it once. If you want it to start up on boot every time you boot, then you just do a sudo chmod plus x slash etc slash rc.d slash rc.nfsd. Then it's marked executable, and your system during boot knows, you know, sees that it's executable and therefore executes it. So now NFS is running. You are now running an NFS server. Are you exporting any directory? No, not yet. The place that you do that is not where you'd think it would be, which you're probably thinking, well, it's probably in slash etc slash NFS something or another. No, it's not. It's slash etc slash exports, E-X-P-O-R-T-S. Or you can put individual files in slash etc slash exports dot d. But I'm just going to put it into the exports file because that's handy right now. Okay, so I'll open that up, and this is on the server. So in my case, this is on my little virtual machine. And there's a nuance here that you need to know about with virtual machines, but it's not a big deal. It's just a nuance of virtual machines. So, but it could trip you up if you're running a bunch of virtual machines. And I say that because I got tripped up by it while I was setting this up, and it took me a good 20 minutes to figure out what I was doing wrong. So I'm just gonna export my home directory on this virtual machine. So that's slash home slash bogus. That's the user on my virtual machine is bogus, B-O-G-U-S. That's my test user on accounts. And then I'm going to do a tab and dash sync, S-Y-N-C, comma, no underscore subtree underscore check, comma, all underscore squash, comma, RW. Those are a bunch of different options. Look at the man exports for details on the different configuration options. The no subtree check is actually new to me. Apparently in new versions of NFS, you need to specify, I guess, a subtree for the thing that you are exporting. I don't really know what that means. I just did it because the little warning message told me, hey, you should set this so that you don't see this warning anymore. I didn't look into it. RW, as you can imagine, read and write. You could also just do RO for read only. And then I'm going to do a space, and this is the thing that tripped me up, 192.168.122.1. That's not my IP range. That is the virtual bridge device between the virtual machine and my desktop machine. That tripped me up because I thought I kept exporting it to the IP address of my desktop, which is like 10.0.0.1, or it's not 10. What am I talking about? 10. Anyway, it's in the 10 address range. So 192.168.122.1 is the virtual bridge. And so as far as my virtual machine knows, it's sending stuff to 192.168.1.2.2.1. And when I try to mount that, that's what I'm showing up as in the virtual machine. So you do have to think about depending on your network, you have to think about how you look to the computer that you're going to. I mean, unless it's a virtual machine, that's not something that you actually have to think about. Now, you could also, you know, if you're running a domain server, you could just put a host name there, or if you just want to manually input the host names into your host /etc/hosts file, you could do that. Then I could just put like Klaatu desktop, whatever. But that's what I'm doing. I'm doing IP address. So then I'll do parentheses RW for read and write for this specific user now. I think I put, yeah, a non-UID equals 1000 and a non-GID equals 100. That's just kind of conforming to this particular host. So that works. I'll save that and close it. And then I'm going to restart. So that's sudo... not restart the computer, just restart the daemon. Sudo sh slash etsy slash rc dot d slash rc dot nfsd, which reminds me I should go over here and unmount my demo folder so that I can remount it and just make sure it's still working. Okay, so I've restarted the NFS directory on my virtual machine, or the server on my virtual machine. It's good to go. It's running now. It's exporting this directory. So now on my desktop, where I want to see all the files in /home/bogus of my virtual machine, I need to be running NFS here as well. And that's a little bit surprising. I mean, you get a fairly good warning, I think, when you try to mount the NFS volume. It tells you, like, you're not running the correct utilities. So that's, again, NFS-utils provides a bunch of components that both sides need to be running. So I'm just going to do the same exact thing. Well, I'm going to start the service the same way. Sudo sh slash etsy rc.d rc.nfsd start. And now it's running on my desktop computer. Now, I'm not exporting anything here. I could be if I wanted to be, but I'm not. I'm just running the daemon so I can talk to the server. Okay, so to talk to the server, I'm going to do a sudo mount dash t nfs. And this is the only reason, like, this is a little bit tricky. It seems like I'm just running the mount command, right? But it's one of those funny mount commands where it's like you're actually running, some kind of NFS mount command. I don't remember what it's called. It's probably in the package that I'm talking about right now. But that's why you need to be running the NFS daemon. And then I'm going to tell it where just like when you're mounting something else, like what you want to mount and then where you want to mount it to. So 192.168.122.82, that's the virtual machine IP address, /home/bogus, and this is where I want to mount it to on my desktop computer, /mnt/, what have I got available, zip. I don't use mnt/zip very often. There we go. It's mounted. And if I cd into /mnt/zip, if I do an ls, I should see, I'm going to just predict here, I should see all the usual home directory folders and a hello world.txt from 2 or 3 episodes ago whenever I was when I was sending stuff with Netcat or whatever. So here's an ls. Yep, and there it is. There's all the stuff. There's a hello world.txt. There's my snmpd.conf sample, my mutt sample, like all the scattered files here from previous episodes are all here. And can I echo hello? Well, let's do quote hello NFS. That doesn't really say hello. There we go. Hello NFS. Redirect into I guess I'll just call it nfs.txt. Yes, I can. So I can both read and write. If I do a cat hello world.txt, there's hello world or something. Actually, it's a blank file right now because I must have done something to it. But anyway, yeah, there's stuff here. I'll look at the snmp.conf. Oh, there's some stuff. Yep. Yeah, so it works, in other words. And that's how easy it is to run an NFS server. For as much power as it gives you, which is just kind of a magically distributed file system over your network, that you can invisibly understand everything that I've done here. You can do invisibly, you can set it up once, and then it just appears like that all the time. It's just so nice. It really is. And as far as your computer feels, it's just a local directory. It's just a normal directory like anything else in your file system tree. It's just so cool. So, yeah, you can start the daemon automatically on your server. And once it's started, it is actively sharing whatever you've got in /etc/exports. And you can automatically start it on your desktop. And you can auto-mount through fstab the directory that you want to auto-mount. So it's really that easy. And it is, it's pretty slick. So try that out. If you're not running NFS and you have a need for a quick and easy file share on your network, NFS is not the worst thing to try. It's kind of nice. And Slackware does. I feel like Slackware makes it pretty easy. The one place you're going to get kind of confused, I think, if I had to predict, it'll be that it'll be the configuration, the exports. There are a lot of different options there. I will paste in what I had into the show notes so you can go to the website and look if you need exactly like what definitely works. But obviously, you know, IP address and certain things might be different on your network. So you'll have to adjust it. But that kind of, it can be that simple. And then you can look through the man page and play around with a bunch of different options. That's kind of the way I like to work, is where I, you know, get something that's definitely working, read, write. Yep, it mounts, it's good. And then start messing around with all the details. Next up is nftables. So nftables is, as I've said before, kind of the replacement, the Linux replacement for IP tables. Not that IP tables necessarily needed replacement, from what I understand. I mean, I haven't really looked into this, like the reasoning or the rationale behind it all. All I know is that there's IP tables, and now for Linux, there's nftables as well. Netfilter is what nf stands for, and the command that it uses is NFT, not to be confused with the non-fungible token craze that's been going on for a while. Or is it still going on? I don't know. Maybe we all got over that. On Slackware, it is in SBIN. So depending on how you have things configured, you might have to like give it the full path /usr/sbin/nft. Kind of depends. On my virtual machine, I don't have the sudo environment set up as nicely as it ought to be. And so I do have to give the full path user sbin nft. On my desktop, I can just sudo nft because I've got sudo configured with all the correct path additions. So /usr/sbin/nft. And then you can do a couple of different things from here. There's -h to see all the different things you can do. Actually, it doesn't really tell you as much as I would have imagined. I guess you really just kind of need to look at the man page. But there is the -h. But the other thing that you can there are other things that you can do, including list, delete and create, and add a couple of other things. And then the objects that you might be doing these things on are tables. So if I do NFT list tables, for instance, well, right now I get nothing. But that's okay. I mean, that's because no tables exist. So I'm going to do an NFT add table. And then as the type of table, let's see what... Actually, I'm going to do dash H again to see if it gives me kind of iterations. No, it doesn't look like it does. Okay, I was hoping for maybe it would give me like more, you know, help just based on where I am during the command, but it doesn't seem to be doing that. Okay, so add table. The next thing that you want to do is define what kind of table you are adding. And in this case, it's just going to be inet. The other kinds of tables could be like specifically IP6 or just IP if you want to restrict your table to IP version 4, ARP, bridge, things like that. So in this case, I'm just going to do INET, which is kind of an all-encompassing everything internet, like all traffic, IP4, IP6. So INET, and then we need to name the table. I'll just call it my table. Okay, so now my table presumably has been added. Now if I do an NFT list tables, there it goes. Table inet my table. So now it knows that it has a table. What is a table? Well, NF tables, table is kind of the main category of that holds all the other things involved in a firewall. I think IP tables had it set up a little bit differently. The hierarchy was different. So in NF tables, and I don't remember what it is in IP tables, so I'm not going to like compare and contrast. I'm just going to say in NF tables, a table is where you hold all of your chains, and chains contain all of your rules. So that's the hierarchy. First, you need a table. Then in the table, you put some chains, and then in those chains, you create some rules. So we might as well create a chain first, because that's kind of a likely next step in real life. A chain can be input, it can be output. There aren't like specific kinds of there are no preset chains in NF tables. I don't know why not. I would imagine that there would be some assumption, like safe assumptions, but for whatever reason, there aren't any presets. I know that there were presets in IP tables. Like there was definitely an input chain and an output chain and that sort of thing. So you just create your own chain is the short version of it. And the syntax is going to seem pretty familiar. It's NFT space add space chain. And then what kind of table we're targeting. And in this case, we already know that it's the inet chain. If we didn't, we would go back in NFT list tables, and then we would have gotten table inet my table. And that is actually quite useful because I'd already forgotten what I'd named my table, and it was my table. So that's pretty easy to remember. But then we need to name this chain, and that would be dependent upon what we wanted to do with it. I'm just going to call it my chain for now. In real life, I imagine I would come up with something a little bit more driven by purpose. And now we need to give the definition of what this chain is actually, like what kind of chain this is. Because again, there are no presets here. We're defining everything on our own. And the chain definition occurs in curly braces, and it consists of a type, a hook, a device, and a priority. And this is all really, really well documented in the man page, but the type can be a filter, which is it's the standard chain type. Use it when you're in doubt, it says literally in the man page. So it's kind of the catch-all. It's just, it provides you pretty much with all of the things. But if you know that you need something specific, like a NAT, then that'll target IP, IP6, and INET tables, traffic. And for the hooks that it provides you, and a hook is like essentially a tap in your network traffic. Like you can kind of get in there when packets are coming in or going out, depending on whether, you know, where you put this hook, and then do something to them. So a NAT chain gives you access to the hooks for pre-routing, for input-output, post-routing. A route-type chain targets IP and IP6, and it gives you an output hook. So those are your choices, and in this case, I'll just do a NFT add chain inet my tape. Did I run through this? Yeah, I've already done this. So add chain inet my table my chain. And then in curly braces, I'm going to put the type. I'm going to literally type the word type, T-Y-P-E. And I'll just make this a filter because I want all the options. And type filter. And then I need to define a hook type that I want to invoke. Let's just do input. That seems like a good place to start. Check the input, check incoming packets. Now again, the different kinds of hooks you have to choose from are input, output, there's post-routing, pre-routing, and forwarding, or forward rather, F-O-R-W-A-R-D. And I'll give that the priority of 0. And I'm going to do a semicolon and create a policy for this chain. And the default policy for this chain is going to be either accept, reject, or drop. I'm going to put accept in this case. I think I terminate it with a semicolon and then terminate it with the curly brace. Let's see if that happens. No, of course it doesn't. I forgot the quotes around the curly braces so that Bash doesn't try to interpret it as a part of the command. And there we go. Now we've got a chain within my table. So my table contains one chain so far called my chain, and this is an input chain, or really it's a chain, a filter. It's a chain of the type filter with an input hook being used, which the policy upon a match, if this is incoming packet, the policy is to accept it. And just as with tables, you can get a bit of a report on what you've got so far with NFT space list space chains. This lists the table inet my table, curly brace, chain my chain, curly brace, type filter hook input priority filter semicolon, policy accept semicolon, curly brace. So you get kind of a, you know, the full sort of dump of your configuration with that list command. So all this chain does, my chain, all this does is find packets in the network, in the traffic that match incoming, but their IP headers tell NetFilter that they must be incoming because of where they're from. So in order to do something with traffic that matches that chain, you need to add rules. So the hierarchy now is my table, or a table contains chains, which contain rules. Let's just do a quick experiment here over on my desktop machine. I'll do an SSH bogus at 192.168.122.82. Yep, it's asking me for my password, bogus 123, and there we go, we're connected. Last login, June 25th at 1902. Yep, that sounds right. Okay, so that works. Now I'm back over on the virtual machine. I'm going to add a rule to reject the SSH traffic from my desktop. So to do that, I'm going to do sudo user usr slash sbin slash nft add rule this time. And I have to identify where I'm adding this rule to. And that is inet my table my chain. That feels a little bit unnatural to me. I'm not really 100% sure why you have to define the type of table. It's inet my table, I guess, because you could have maybe the same name of a table under some other category. I will say that there's a little bit of uneasiness with some of these commands where it's just like, what do you need from me? And it doesn't seem to be super helpful in telling you what it wants. It just, you're just kind of left on your own. So my table, my chain, yeah, inet my table, my chain, space, IP, so that's the, IP traffic, SADDR, which is source address. Don't love these abbreviations either, but maybe to people used to IP tables, it all makes sense. I don't know. Adder. And there is a list, again, in the man page of all the different kind of tools that you have to experiment around with. And I'll do, as we know from our NFS experiment, it's 192.168.122.1 space TCP. This will be coming over. This will be TCP traffic, not UDP. And the destination port, so that's D port. That one I do recognize from IP tables. D port, space 22, of course. And then let's do a reject. Let's not drop it, because I actually want to see that I want to get a message back. Okay, so I hit return on that, and now I'm back over on my desktop. And I'm going to attempt to, where's my SSH command? I guess I have to retype it. SSH bogus at 192.168.122.82 connect to host, connection refused. So I've just blocked myself out of my virtual machine, but that's okay, because I'm running it in a window here as well, and I can still get in. But that's the workflow, more or less. Table chain rule. And once you have chains, you can add lots and lots of rules to them. The chains are the container for all the different hooks that you're using to find matching kinds of traffic that you want to then manipulate. So you can have lots of chains, you can have lots of rules, and you can have different tables as well. But this brings me back, or it compels me to go back to NF account or NFACCT, which I skipped before I started talking about NFS. And NFACCT is poorly documented. There is some data about it on the NetFilter wiki, which you can look at, but it's essentially sort of a logging tool, but really it's more like, I guess, monitoring. It allows you to create what are called accounting objects, hence the NFACCT. You create these accounting objects, and then you can send packets sort of through them, or you can kind of log packets into these accounting objects. And so you get like stats on what kind of traffic and what kind of matches you're getting. So for instance, to create an accounting object, it's sudo user sbin nfacct space add space my counts, or let's do my logs. Even it's not really logging, but let's call it my log, my logs, whatever, my log. And then in order to, so now the accounting object exists, and you can confirm that it exists by just doing an NFACCT list, and that'll show you what objects you have. And it'll give you a bunch of zeros, because right now you're not sending anything through this accounting object, it's just, it exists. So it's got packets, zero, bytes, zero, my logs, semicolon. But you can send stuff. You can start accruing like data here by creating a rule. So sudo user sbin nft add rule. Of course, inet my table, my chain. Actually, no, filter input. Yeah, IP SADDR, your source IP address. Let's say it's 192.168.122.1 again. And then counter, counter, counter my logs. So you're just finding a match from a source address. And of course, it doesn't have to be from a single address. You could open it up to an entire subnet or to an entire whatever. But you can then counter my log, or actually counter space name space my logs, and that sends the statistics of those matches into my logs. You can retrieve the stats again with NFACCT list. That shows you the data, and you can reset them or delete them with either delete or the keyword zero. So if you want to reset, you can do sudo user sbin NFACCT zero my logs, and that'll zero it out. So if you want to see how much traffic you're getting from a specific block of IP addresses overnight, you could do that and come in the morning, see what you got, zero them out, see how it performs during the day, or whatever your use case. It's not well documented. If you go to netfilter.org, you get a little bit of information, but really the place you're going to really need to go to is wiki.netfilter.org. filter.org and have a look around there, because it doesn't seem to be something that I guess a lot of people are using, because you just don't find much about it online. But and there's no documentation in the Git repo. I've cloned the entire NFACCT repository, no docs, nothing at all. So if you want to use that feature, just look on the wiki and find out more about it. That's everything, I think, for this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening, and keep the source open.
Free moment, I'd like to tell you about the latest nightmare I've had.